The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240. WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. I'm Bill Donahue. I'll be taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 7th day of May. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight, as usual. Once again, it's book season, and up first, we'll welcome in three-time world champion Los Angeles Laker and former head coach of the New Jersey Nets, Byron Scott. And we'll discuss his new book, Slam Dunk Success, Leading from Every Position of Life's Court. And in the second half, we'll welcome in former PR man of the New York Yankees and really a prolific author in his own right. Marty Appel will join us. We'll talk about his new book, Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character. So sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight. We've got some great stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. Stop by, give us a look, then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest, as we said, three-time NBA champion with the Showtime Lakers, went on to two NBA finals as coach of the Nets. His new book titled Slam Dunk Success, Leading from Every Position on Life's Court. Welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Coach Byron Scott. Coach, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you grew up in Inglewood, California. You played at Morningside High School in the shadow of what was then the home of the Lakers, the Forum. You played your college ball at Arizona State. Who were your favorite players, Byron? Any idols, your favorite teams back then?
Well, my favorite team was the Lakers. You know, I grew up watching them, and but my favorite player to watch at the time was Bob McAdoo. I was a big Bob McAdoo fan, and rooted for the Buffalo Braves, who obviously, you know, later on became the San Diego Clippers, who are now the L.A. Clippers. And I just loved a big man at 6'10", 6'11", back in those days that could really shoot the ball. So it was something that, you know, I just found fascinating, and I just grew to really love McAdoo. And fortunately for me, I got an opportunity to play with him in Los Angeles my rookie year. And,
exactly, yeah.
He was just a great character, a great person, and we had a great time together, and let him know that I was a big, you know, big fan of his back in the day.
Yeah, we've had Bob on the program, a really good man, and he could really do it all, definitely. Now, you were selected by the Clippers, as we said, who were in San Diego back then with the fourth pick in the 83 draft. Then you get traded to the Lakers for Norm Nixon. That must have been some great feeling.
It was, you know, being able to be in your backyard was a blessing. I was really excited about it. And, you know, the Lakers at that particular time, you know, were, like I said, my favorite team. But the guys didn't welcome me with open arms because of the fact that Norm Nixon was very popular.
Yeah.
So I had to just work my way and, you know, and win them and let them know that I was, you know, here to play and try to help them win championships.
Certainly. Now, we talk about the Showtime Lakers, Byron. Fill the folks in on exactly what that means, the Showtime Lakers.
You know what? I think that's a term that Magic Johnson invented. You know, just
okay.
You know, come to the late game and just watch a show. You know, we really, you know, try to just make sure that our fans got everything and, you know, that they deserved as far as, you know, spending their hard-earned money. And we wanted to make sure we put on the show, but also we wanted to win games. So it was something that just kind of came naturally to him, and just his razzle-dazzle on the basketball court and the way he approached the game. And all of a sudden, everybody was just calling it Showtime, so it just kind of stuck with us.
Okay. Now, as we said, several Hall of Famers on the Laker ball club. Talk a little bit about Magic Johnson and what he meant to the Lakers and about what he meant to basketball in general back then.
Well, you know, I think at that along And then obviously Michael Jordan, the league really started to flourish again. Before that time, I can't remember exactly, but it was probably 20 teams, 22 teams in the NBA, and only three teams were really making money. The NBA TV deal wasn't nowhere near like it is today. And Magic and Bird, you know, they brought that Lakers-Celtic rivalry back, and they brought that that appeal back to the NBA. So they really, really were the catalyst of turning the league around and making it prosperous again and making it something fun to watch.
Okay, now James Worthy, a Hall of Famer, Jamal Wilkes, Keith Wilkes back then, and, of course, the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, one of the greatest ever. Talk a little bit about Kareem for us, Byron.
Well, like you said, one of the greatest ever, and I still think, you know, he doesn't get talked about enough. I know Michael Jordan, how great he was. Magic Johnson, there's no doubt about it. When you talk about greatest players of all time, those guys should definitely be mentioned. But Kareem had a shot that was unstoppable. I mean, he was, you know, the NBA leading scorer when he left the game, and it still is to this day. You know, so sometimes, you know, when we get in those type of discussions, you know, I always bring Kareem's name up as probably the greatest player that's ever played the game, because when you look at his impact and the things that he was able to do from a young age until his, you know, later stage of his career, he still was one of the guys that you had no answer for, you know, defensively. There's really nothing you could do against him when he got into that sky hook. So, you know, I've always said that he's one of the greatest, if not the greatest player to ever play the game.
Definitely. And you look at a guy like Nolan Ryan, too, in baseball. Kareem did it for so long. He stayed in the, and he was really at the top of his game all the way through.
He really was. I mean, you know, 20 years that he played in the NBA, and you got a lot of guys now, well, not a lot, but you got a few guys that's been able to accomplish that feat of playing that long and have that type of longevity. But most of those guys are coming out of high school. You know, Kareem had to go to college for 4 years and came out, you know, the number one pick, 22 years old, and, you know, played until he was 42. So it's something that's not going to be done often. And again, like I said, his longevity and the way he was able to dominate the game for so many years, you know, puts him in that category of being the greatest of all time.
Certainly. We got Byron Scott with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. In 96-97, we'll go to the end for a while of your career, Byron. You went back to the Lakers, and you were sort of a mentor for guys like Shaq, Eddie Jones, Nick Van Exel, and, of course, there was an 18-year-old rookie on the ball club by the name of Kobe Bryant.
Right. Well, that was a lot of fun. You know, going back to the Lakers, I wanted to retire a Laker and get an opportunity to play with Shaq and Eddie Jones and Nick Van Exel, Jerome, you know, the late, great Jerome Kersey, who was a great friend of mine.
Oh, yeah.
And Kobe Bryant. You know, it was such a pleasure to go back there and kind of mentor that young man, and now to see what he's, you know, become, you know, after 20 years of playing. You know, I always feel good about that because I always feel I had a very, very tiny bit to do with that, and just kind of telling him how we went about our business and how professional he was in all the times that I saw him play.
Definitely. I'm sure you had a lot to do with it. Now, we'll look at the 85 NBA Finals. Of course, it's Lakers-Celtics, classic matchup. You lost to them in the previous year, but you guys were on a mission that year in 85.
We really were. And if you remember, you know, as much as we were on a mission in game one, you know, Memorial Day Massacre, as they called it,
yeah,
you know, we get beat by 47 points. So it didn't look good at the beginning of that series. But, man, we gathered ourselves. We got our focus back. You know, went through about 3 days of real intense practice and film session and came back to win that series 4-2.
And you really cruised through the playoffs against Phoenix, Portland, and the Nuggets, 11-2 in three playoff rounds. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it was. And in the Western Conference at that particular time was pretty tough. So Portland and Denver was one of those teams that was just very high scoring. You know, we knew we had our work cut out, you know, for us. But like you said earlier, I mean, we were so focused and so determined to get back to the finals to meet the Celtics that I don't think we were going to let anybody stop us.
And the coach, of course, for those who don't know, was the great Pat Riley, who we know here in New York from being with the Knicks. But really, his time with the Lakers is what made Coach Riley what he is in history today.
No doubt about it. He was a terrific coach, a great motivator. I mean, really challenged us, you know, to be the greatest team that we could possibly be. I mean, he went down to individuals and made sure that we, you know, came out every year and tried to be even better than we were the year before. So he didn't, he wasn't one of those coaches that allowed us to live on our, you know, our past success. You know, he wanted us to continue to get better and better. And, you know, the mark of a great coach to me is, you know, when he went to New York, he had to change his whole style of ball, you know, because he didn't have those gray horses that can get up and down the floor like we could.
Right.
And he was very successful in New York as well.
Now, in 87, you guys meet Boston again in the finals. You were 65-17 that season. Pat Riley made a pair of moves, shifting the offensive focus, really, to Magic Johnson, and he acquired Michael Thompson via trade midway through the season, and that helped take the load off of Kareem.
No, it really did. Jerry West was really the architect of getting Michael Thompson to our team. We don't know how he did it, but, man, to be able to get another big like Michael Thompson to back up Kareem was a genius, you know, play on his part. And like you said, Riles went to Magic and said, look, we need you to be a little bit more aggressive offensively to make us all better. And, you know, Magic was a little reluctant to do that because that's just not his nature. But, boy, you know, he kind of took it to heart, and he was much more aggressive that season, and we were just much more of a better basketball team.
Sure. Now, the path to the finals was pretty smooth that year, too. You swept the Nuggets in the first round, beat Golden State in five games in the second round, and then you sweep the Supersonics in the conference finals. Not too bad.
No, not bad at all. And again,
no.
It was just the fact that we were, you know, just a driven team again. We were just hell-bent on, you know, getting to the finals again and trying to win another championship. And, you know, like I said, Pat Riley was a great motivator. So he was able to hit the right buttons at the right time to keep us focused throughout the playoffs.
He sure did. Now, in 88, Byron, Pat Riley guarantees a repeat. Now, how did you guys feel about the guarantee from Coach Riley?
Well, you know, he said it right up in the Forum parking lot where we were having another parade and
right,
all our fans
yeah.
were there. And, you know, we were still just celebrating, you know, a championship and just feeling good about what we had just accomplished. And, you know, so when he said that, we were all shocked. You know, we were all just kind of like, what is he doing? You know, he's not getting a chance to enjoy this one. And, you know, it was just one of those things that he was very calculating the way he was doing it because he knew the group of guys that he had would all of a sudden start focusing again. And, you know, everything was kind of put on hold. You know, our vacations and everything, everybody just kind of went back to work. And, you know, we were able to definitely, you know, fulfill that dream of ours. And obviously his guarantee was something we were able to fulfill, too. So it was a great calculated move on his part.
Definitely. And you came up against a real tough Pistons squad with Chuck Daly at the helm, Dennis Rodman, Joe Dumars, Lambeer, guys like that.
Isaiah Thomas. Yeah,
oh, yeah, I forgot. I'm sorry.
Yeah, very good basketball team. And Rick Mahorn, so they had some beef. They were physical. They were tough. And, you know, we got stunned the first game. They came into L.A. and beat us. And, again, we just kind of gathered ourselves and knew that we had to go to Detroit to win a game. But great series against a great team and a great coach. Chuck Daly, the late, great Chuck Daly, was one of the best coaches I've ever seen and ever been around. I had the opportunity to play golf with him in Detroit a couple of times, and he was really just a terrific coach and a terrific player.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Definitely. Now, the aftermath from that, Byron, the chance for a three-peat took a blow. You and Magic Johnson had hamstring injuries, so that next season didn't quite work out the way everybody wanted.
No, it didn't. I mean, we got ourselves back to the finals, and we played extremely well throughout the playoffs. And, you know, the night before the finals was starting, I tore my hamstring, and then the game won, Magic pulled his. So, you know, the hopes of three-peating was kind of shattered, you know, that last couple of days. But still was a great accomplishment to get there and compete again, but it didn't end up the way we wanted it to.
Definitely not, and that's a real shame. We're speaking of Byron Scott tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You went to Greece to play, Byron, for a period. What made you want to go to Greece and play?
You know what? I went for 1 year, and I finished with Los Angeles, and I just said, you know, I want to play one more year, and I want to play overseas. My ex-wife had been to Greece because her father was in the military, and we got a call from Panathinaikos, and they were very interested in me coming there, and so we, signed a deal for me to go over there and play for 1 year, and it was a great experience of just being overseas and getting a different culture. And my kids were in the school over there, and then the with the ambassadors, U.S. ambassadors' children. So it was something that I'll never forget, and I had a lot of fun. And we won the championship that year as well over there.
Sounds like a great experience. Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Nets now. As everybody remembers you from this area, as also the coach of the Jersey Nets, 52 wins. They bring in Jason Kidd. You win the Atlantic Division crown, and you appear in the NBA Finals against, ironically, the Lakers. Talk a little bit about that year with the Nets.
You know, it was a great year. We made the trade and got Jason Kidd, and we had some young guys that really just developed, Kenyon Martin and Richard Jefferson, and Jason Collins. So we just had a very, very good, solid basketball team, and we got to the finals, and our guys were a little overwhelmed, to play the Lakers the first game because we had never been there. So you're talking about a team that's very experienced that we were going against. And, we battled. We played, as hard as we could. And I was very proud of the way our guys played and performed. But it just wasn't – we just wasn't mentally, ready, because that was just a big stage. And, just getting there to the finals was a big-time accomplishment.
Sure was. Now, the next year you go to the finals again – but you come up against a real tough San Antonio Spurs ball club.
Yeah, Tim Duncan in his prime, and Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili, they were just great basketball players, great team. Popovich, one of the best coaches in this league.
Oh, yeah.
So, it was, again, a great series. I think they beat us 4-2, but, I was very, again, very proud of the way our team played.
Now, there were rumors, Byron, that you and Jason Kidd had some problems, but you have something different to say about that.
You know what? You always have problems with some superstars, in some shape or form.
Yeah.
All of it's, water under the bridge. Jason was a great player for us in New Jersey. Things didn't work out the way we expected it to, and that's myself included. But at that time, I just thought it was time for me to move on and let the team go in a different direction. And that's exactly what Rod Thorne thought as well. So, when I left, I didn't leave with no ill will or any bad feelings whatsoever.
Great, yeah. But you certainly left your mark, because the Nets have not been successful since then, and they're pretty unsuccessful now. So people remember that great run, especially now that they're in Brooklyn. Now, it had to be a dream for you, though, Byron, to go back to L.A. and coach the Lakers, a team that you had such great success with.
It really was. I mean, if there was any coaching job that I wanted, it was, to coach in Los Angeles, my hometown, the team that I loved for so many years, the organization that I love. Dr. Butts was such a great person and a great owner and great to me. So, that was definitely a dream come true.
Now, let's talk about the book, Slam Dunk Success, Leading from Every Position on Life's Court. What made you write this book?
You know what? It's funny how the book even got started. Charlie Norris, my co-author, and I were workout buddies, and Charlie's a little bit older than I am, and we were laying on the mat one day after one of our good workouts, and he said, we should write a book. And I said, yeah, it should be a workout book on how to work out when you're 50 years and older.
Yeah.
And we really just kind of laughed about it, and we talked about having pictures in there and doing a bunch of weights and doing cardio stuff, and Charlie wanted us to meet with a friend of his who used to manage Sean Penn and Madonna, named Todd Smith. And Todd just had all these big wild ideas about a book and doing radio and TV and all this stuff. And, we kind of looked at him like he was crazy. But, boy, 2.5 years later, we come out with this great book that we feel is for everybody. If you're an entrepreneur, or if you are 18 years old, or if you're 60 years old, it's something in this book that we feel can really help you if you're getting into business or in sports. Because there is a parallel between the two, and we really felt that was really the catch.
Definitely. Now, for those folks who haven't seen the book, the foreword is by Mr. Magic Johnson, so that's something to check out,
right,
too. What's your favorite chapter, your favorite topic in the book, Byron?
I think my favorite topic is leadership. And, you know, Charlie and I both talk about our leadership, you know, skills and what we feel we bring to the table. And from a basketball standpoint and from a business standpoint, we also saw that there's a lot of similarities in leading a basketball team as it is leading a business or a corporation. You know, so when you talk about the leadership aspect, I think that's probably my favorite chapter. And then one of my other favorite chapters is we talk a lot about our failures as well. You know, I talk about, you know, getting fired from Jersey and the Lakers and Cleveland and how many times I've been knocked on my butt and how many times I've gotten right back up. And, you know, he's talked about his failures as well, because we also feel that you have to celebrate those failures and you have to learn from them, you know, because if you don't learn from them, you don't grow. So, you know, those are some of the chapters that I really enjoy.
Certainly some valuable information there, definitely. What other current projects do you have going, Byron? What's keeping you busy these days besides writing books?
Oh, working at ESPN has been a joy the last couple of seasons. I really enjoy doing the basketball analyst part and talking about the game that I love so much. You know, that's been one of the things that I've really gotten a lot of enjoyment out of, and it's something that I'm going to probably continue to do. I don't know if I'll get back into coaching, and if I do, it's probably going to be on the collegiate level, because I think, you know, you got to grab some of these guys when they're really young, because once I get them in the NBA, a lot of them still don't understand the fundamentals of basketball. So right now I'm just really focusing my attention on the book and ESPN, and I got three grandchildren that I really enjoy being around as well.
Outstanding. Well, I think you'd be successful in the college ranks, Byron, definitely. And I hope that comes true for you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I thank you for taking part out of your Sunday night to be with us. Once again, the book titled Slam Dunk Success, Leading from Every Position on Life's Court. Get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Also, for you folks listening online, you might be on the West Coast, May 13th, I believe it's Friday, coming up. There's a signing with Byron in L.A. at Barnes & Noble. And I hope everybody out on the West Coast listening via TuneIn on the web can get out there. Go meet Brian. Byron, he'll sign your book for you. And once again, Byron, thanks so very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All the best. Byron Scott, folks.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk to former Yankees PR man, author Marty Appel. We'll talk about Casey Stengel, the old professor, and some interesting stories about that gentleman, one of the legends of Major League Baseball. So stay with us, folks.
Long Island's AM 1240, WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GusBuster.com and get your GusBuster today.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
So you see, son, good manners are important. Should I go through it again?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
Exactly. Always say please, thank you, you're welcome, and excuse me. Sit up straight, hold doors open, don't speak with your mouth full, keep your elbows off the table. Share your things, play nice, and generally treat others the way you'd like to be treated. Got it?
Got it.
And stop picking your nose.
Most parenting is hard to do in just 2 minutes. But 2 minutes twice a day, making sure they brush their teeth, is easier. And it could help save them from a lifetime of tooth pain. Visit 2min2x.org to find out more. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ag Council.
Hi, I'm Matt Kenseth. You don't have to be a race car driver to know that life can be full of drama. Some of it you can't control, like mechanical issues, high winds, and rain delays. But there's some drama you can skip.
Skip the drama that comes with not having your high school diploma or equivalency. Find free adult education classes near you and finish your diploma. Visit finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org.
You just need to take that first step and find free classes near you and leave the drama for the racetrack.
Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ed Council.
How can I help my daughter with her reading?
Searching for help with Dachshund reading.
No.
Let me try. Sarah's bright, but when she's reading, she has trouble sounding out words.
Playing world music.
What?
I give up.
Wait, I was trying to show you how Sarah feels every day. Redirecting to understood.org.
Join parents and experts at understood.org, a free online resource about learning and attention issues to help your child thrive.
Brought to you by understood.org and the Ad Council.
Well, Jason, I've got to tell you, you're pretty much everything this company is looking for in an entry-level candidate.
Great.
Your resume isn't quite what we're used to, but you've got a fantastic work ethic.
Thank you.
And I'm impressed by how you carry yourself.
So, should we talk about the job?
What, the job? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I have no way of recruiting or even meeting you. This interview didn't happen.
It may sound ridiculous, and that's because it kind of is. There's a huge pool of talent your company is missing out on. Meet the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
Man, we really could have used him.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening, the 7th day of May. I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. The Rangers really take it on the chin last night, losing in Ottawa 5-4. We have Matt Harvey suspended from the hobbling Mets. Goodness knows what's up with Matt and what happened in that situation. We take a look at the Yankees in Chicago. They're really laying a beating down on the world champion Cubs, so we'll have to keep an eye on that. So my next guest, folks, is a former PR man for the New York Yankees and a real successful author in his own right. His new book is titled Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character. I welcome back to the show Marty Appel. Marty, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. Thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you.
Great to have you with us, Marty. Now, right off the bat, no pun intended, I want to ask you, what's your impression of these 2017 Yankees so far?
Well, it totally caught me by surprise.
Yeah.
I did not see this coming. It's still early in the season and things happen. But what fun they are to watch. It's been a delight. And Aaron Judge, main thing that's impressed me about him is making contact. Last year he struck out half his times at bat, and that's a hard thing to overcome. You're sort of always that kind of a player, but he's not. He changed, and that's a huge thing to me.
Definitely. We will see if the Yankees can maintain this current level of play. That'll be the key, whether the starting pitching holds up, so we'll just keep an eye on them this season. And for those unfamiliar with you, Marty, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your past role and experience with the Yankees. You must have some tremendous stories.
Well, thanks, and sure I do. But I trace my connection to the team back to the 1955 World Series when I was a seven-year-old fan. And Brooklyn beat the Yankees, and my seven-year-old heart was broken because I thought, oh, I'm going to root for the underdogs from now on.
Imagine.
Poor Yankees. So, I mean, and I was living in Brooklyn. So in a sense, my whole life has been a mistake. I was supposed to have been a Brooklyn fan, but I became a Yankee fan when they lost that series. I went to work for the team in 1968 on the basis of a letter I sent to them. They hired me to answer Mickey Mantle's fan mail. So I'm kind of the last one active in the business who worked in the original stadium and worked there when Mickey Mantle was still playing. I stayed with the Yankees as in PR. I became PR director. And then I was executive producer of the telecasts, and that was like a 20-year run. I had a side career writing books. I've done about two dozen books now, a lot of them Yankee-themed. And I continue to have a relationship with the Yankees, contributing to their website and their publications. So it's all been good.
Outstanding. Now, we'll take a look at the topic of your latest book, which is The Great Casey Stengel. Charles Dillon Stengel. How did he get the nickname Casey, Marty?
Because he was from Kansas City.
Right.
Probably early in his career, maybe his rookie season, somebody in the Brooklyn Dodger clubhouse would have said, "Hey, Rook, where are you from?" And he would have said, "KC." And a nickname was born.
It's as simple as that, sure. Now, people may not realize, Marty, that Casey Stengel was the only man to wear the uniform of all four New York Major League Baseball teams.
Right. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He played for the New York Giants. He managed the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he managed the Yankees, and he managed the Mets. Really, there's nobody around today who remembers him as a player, but he was a pretty good player. He probably would have made a couple of All-Star teams had they had those back then. 284 lifetime, over 14 seasons, four World Series teams. And then, of course, he begins a long and unsuccessful managing career in the minor leagues and a couple of major league teams. And then he strikes gold with the Yankees when they hire him in 1949.
Certainly. Now, people may not know also, Marty, that Casey set out, really, to be a dentist.
That's a great story, Bill.
Yeah.
His parents wanted him to have a fallback career. So they encouraged him to go to Western Dental College right in Kansas City. And he went for three semesters during his off seasons from minor league baseball. But after that third semester, he quit. He decided dentistry was really not cut out for a left-hander because they simply didn't make left-handed dental equipment. If you think about it, most dentists even today are right-handed. But as I ask in the book, what took them so long to figure that out?
Yeah.
You'd have thought they might have addressed that on his first day of registration.
Right.
Don't have the answer.
No, okay. Now, Casey started out as a pitcher. We talk about him hitting in the 280s, but he really started out as a pitcher.
Well, he was a pitcher in high school and some amateur ball that he played, but when he got to the minor leagues in 1910, he became an outfielder, and that was his position for the rest of his career.
Now, he signed with the Dodgers, and as you said, I think it was at 10 or 11. He gained a reputation right off the bat as an eccentric. Now, one scout says he's a dandy ball player, but it's all from the neck down. How did Casey get this reputation as an eccentric ball player?
Well, it probably started as a kid when he and his brother used to throw snowballs at men with pipes, trying to knock the pipes out of their faces. And he, that little rascal part of him was always there. The funny thing I stumbled on through the magic of digitized newspapers going all the way back, he started his pro career in Kankakee, Illinois in 1910. And the team was called the Kankakee K's, but the ballpark was next door to a asylum for the insane. And the newspapers took to calling the team the Lunatics. So none of this is politically correct today.
Right.
But it was a gift to me as a writer to be able to say that Casey started his career as a lunatic.
Yeah. And he may have continued through the rest of his career as
well,
as the
indeed.
Same.
Yep.
We're speaking to Marty Appel tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, he played with Brooklyn from 1912 to 1917, and he had a history of holding out before each season in contract disputes.
Yeah, even as a young man, he was feisty when it came to contract.
Uh-huh.
Kind of knew his worth. He was on the 1916 pennant-winning Brooklyn club that played against Babe Ruth and the Braves in the World Series. But he knew that he had a value, and when the Federal League was formed, offering competition to the National League and the American League, the owner of the Dodgers, Charles Ebbets, quickly went around the country and signed up his players for, like, two-year deals. So Casey was, in a good position there without having to jump leagues.
Sure. Now, in 1919, Marty, there's a great story. Stengel goes to the Pirates, and he comes back to Brooklyn, and he's taunted mercilessly by fans of the Dodgers. And I think you know where I'm going here.
Yeah, I can tell the story.
Take it. Yeah, go ahead.
He was being booed because he was an enemy player.
Right.
Actually, in their hearts, they always liked Casey Stengel in Brooklyn. But he was being booed, and when the inning ended and he was in the outfield, he scooped up a sparrow, not an uncommon bird in Brooklyn, and he tucked it under his cap. And when he came to bat and the fans were booing, he bowed gracefully and tipped his cap, and the sparrow flew out, and it was his way of giving the fans the bird.
Yeah.
And they loved him forever after in Brooklyn.
Amazing.
Or maybe until he came back as manager of the Yankees.
Oh, yeah. That certainly would turn their spirits a little bit. Now, he played in three World Series in 16 with the Dodgers, and in 22-23 for the Giants. So he had a pretty successful career.
Yeah, in fact, in 23 with the Giants, that World Series was in the first year of the new Yankee Stadium, and he hit two game-winning home runs in that series, the first of which, an inside the Parker, was the first World Series home run ever hit in Yankee Stadium, which just added to his distinguished list because he hit the first home run ever in Ebbets Field. So he has these two mm-hmm. remarkable achievements. Now, on the inside the park home run at Yankee Stadium, he had a rubber insert inside his shoe to guard to protect against an injury. And as he was running the bases, he felt something fall off. He thought he lost a shoe. It was actually the insert that fell out. But he didn't look down. He just kept running. So he slid home, and he said to Hank Gowdy, the on-deck hitter, "I think I lost a shoe." And Hank Gowdy said, "Well, how many were you wearing?"
Yeah. Yeah, another great story of Mr. Stengel. Now, in that series in 23, Marty, he hit the two home runs, but John McGraw still sends him away. Now, he's traded. Dave Beauty Bancroft was involved in the trade, and another Hall of Famer, Billy Southworth. And Casey reports he's lucky he didn't hit three instead of two, because McGraw might have traded him to the 3i League.
There was a hot and cold relationship there with him and McGraw. First of all, he respected John McGraw. He learned so much baseball just sitting at his side. And McGraw respected Stengel, even made him like a coach while he was still a player in spring training with a B squad that was sort of 100 miles away from their training camp. But despite that mutual admiration, McGraw thought Casey was a smart aleck. He didn't necessarily consider him a good man on the team. And after those World Series heroics, poof, he was gone, traded off to Boston.
Yeah. Lo and behold, unbelievable. Now, doing your research for the book, Marty, what was the favorite quote of Casey that you really enjoy?
Well, I like when he said, when you're younger, you get blamed for crimes you never committed, and when you're older, you begin to get credit for virtues you never possessed. It evens itself out.
a good one, which shows he was at the top of his game most of the time, Casey. He wasn't really as big an eccentric as people think. He was pretty sharp.
He was very sharp, even as a businessman. I mean, 1937, height of the Depression, he invested in a Texas oil well that made him a rich man for the rest of his life. He didn't even need his baseball jobs.
Yeah, I remember that, and another great point brought out in the book. We're speaking to Marty Appel tonight about Casey Stengel, the subject of his latest book. Now, people may not know, Marty, where Casey got the nickname the Old Professor.
Very early in his playing career, he had a chance to be an assistant baseball coach at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. They couldn't pay him for that, but they gave him a little teaching job so he would have some income. So he was indeed a professor at Ole Miss, mm-hmm. and out of that came the Old Professor.
Amazing. Great. Okay, now, John McGraw brought him back as he wanted him to be involved with the Toledo Mudhens, which was a classic franchise. So Casey, at his present job, fired himself. He released himself as a player and resigned as president. So he did some finagling there.
That was his first managing assignment. It was in Worcester, Massachusetts. He was named president of the team, and he was a player manager. And then at the end of the season, he had a chance to move up to Toledo, which was a high classification. But the owner of the team wouldn't give him permission. So, remembering that he was also team president, Casey sent a letter to himself, resigning, and then sent a letter back to himself, accepting the resignation and complimenting him on a great job. That's how he got his freedom there.
Amazing. Yeah, great.
Amazing is a good word there.
Yeah. Now, he was a coach with Brooklyn under Hall of Famer Max Carey, and that's how Casey got his job as manager of Brooklyn. Max Carey gets fired, and Casey takes over the reins.
Yeah, that was a famous baseball quote at the time. I doubt people would remember it today, but Bill Terry was managing the rival Giants, and they asked Terry how Brooklyn would finish during the year, and Terry said sarcastically, "Brooklyn, are they still in the league?"
Right.
And when Max Carey didn't respond, the Dodger owners just said, "Wait a minute, we have no response to that?" And they fired Carey, and they promoted Stengel, and that's how he got his first major league job.
The rest, they say, is history. Exactly. Yeah. Now, Bill, he also has a run-in with Bill Veeck, who wasn't in person, but it was Bill Veeck was serving in the South Pacific with the Marines.
Yeah, but he's still he was pretty young still, Veeck, but he owned the Milwaukee Brewers, the minor league Milwaukee Brewers, and Casey was named to manage them without Veeck being there. And when Veeck found out, he was outraged because he didn't think much of Casey Stengel. And Casey had a great year for Milwaukee and did, you know, really brought them in first place. So Veeck wasn't impressed. He still wanted Casey gone. In 1944, this was. And that was a short-lived relationship with Vec and Stengel.
Marty Appel's with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, George Weiss, another Hall of Famer later on, brings Casey into the Yankees. How was the relationship between George Weiss and Casey, Marty?
They always had a friendship. It began that year Casey managed at Worcester, and Weiss was operating the New Haven team in the Eastern League. And they always, they would dine together at the winter meetings and attend World Series games together. So there was always a friendship there. And when the Yankee job became open in 1949, Casey had just won the Pacific Coast League championship with Oakland, where he managed Billy Martin, among others. And Weiss reached out to him and said, would you manage the Yankees? Now, Casey had very little major league, no major league success as a manager, had never been in the American League, either as a player or manager. This was, and had this reputation of being kind of a clown. So this really tested the sensibilities, not only of Yankee fans, but really the whole baseball community. They just didn't regard Casey that high. George Weiss did, and of course the rest, as they say, is history.
Right. Yeah, now he's gaining a reputation as a real tactician, too, with platooning and things like that.
Yeah, I think most people would say he invented platooning, but that wasn't really the case. What he did was have such a wealth of talent available to him that he could platoon and play he could game the whole righty-lefty system, seemingly with always some superstar on the bench ready to go in if the pitcher was right-handed or left-handed. Baseball people always knew there was a righty-lefty thing going on, but very few teams ever had the abundance of talent that Casey did with the Yankees and was able to use it so well.
What do you think, Marty, of the concept that people say anyone could really win with those great Yankee clubs, even Casey Stengel?
Well, you know, you could make that argument because there was such a wealth of talent on the Yankees, and there were only seven competitors. But to win five in a row, as he did his first year out of the box, 49-53, starting with his first year, you know, give the man his due. Maybe not everybody could have pulled that off.
Right, okay. Now, he was dismissed, so to speak, from the Yankees in 1960 after he turned 70, and he was a little bitter about that, with good reason.
Yes, with good reason. They instituted a retirement age policy, which had not existed before. He had lost the seventh game of a 1960 World Series, and in his own words, was told that his services were no longer desired, to which he said, I'll never make the mistake of being 70 again.
Right, yeah.
It was a rough PR decision for the Yankees, certainly. And for a baby boomer generation, of which I'm one, it was like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. I thought Eisenhower was always going to be the president, and I thought Wagner was always going to be the New York City mayor.
Uh-huh.
What's going on here? To people like me, I was 12, it was like, we're never going to win another game. Casey was the guy that made it all happen.
Shocking, yeah.
The real reason behind it, Bill, was that Ralph Houk was the manager in waiting, and everybody thought the world of him. And he proved them right by winning three straight pennants himself. But they didn't want to lose Ralph Houk. And they thought, you know, we could go another year or two with Casey, but we're going to lose Houk in the process. We have to make this move now, even though it's a rough business decision.
Interesting point about the major Ralph Houk there, Marty. Now, George Weiss takes a job at the helm of the expansion New York Mets, and what's the first thing he does is call Casey up.
He calls Casey and persuades him to come back east and manage the expansion Mets. Casey did it for two reasons. Number one, because George Weiss asked him to, and he felt he owed George. Number two, it was a chance to stick it to the Yankees. He was bitter, and if he could compete for newspaper space with the Yankees and get a chance to tweak them a little bit, that perfectly suited what he was looking for. So he came back east at the age of 72. People remember him today, Bill, as like this wrinkled, hobbly old man with bow legs creaking around.
And, right.
You know, he's the same age Terry Collins is.
Yeah. But the way I always viewed Casey, Marty, is that he was looked old when he was 20.
Well, in the 1920s, the newspapers called him Old Casey Stengel.
Yeah.
And partly that was his looks. But he was not a bad-looking guy as a younger player. And when the Dodgers first signed him in 1911, Larry Sutton, the Dodgers scout, said, there's something about blonde-haired kids with blue eyes. They always are fighters, and I like fighters. And that was really what got him his Brooklyn contract.
Okay, yeah, well, he also came up with, as you say, looking for ink, some great quotes when he was skipper of the New York Mets, especially quotes about, that I recall, Eddie Cranepool and the immortal Greg Goosen.
Which was, one's going to be on his way to the Hall of Fame, and the other one has a chance to be 30.
Yeah. Right,
yeah.
Greg Goosen.
Casey was a different manager when he went to the Mets. He knew that the team wasn't really going to succeed. In those days, the expansion teams were just stocked with giveaways from all the other clubs. So Casey recognized his role was going to be PR, and his job was to divert attention from the bad play and bring it on to himself and win over the fan base of New York, particularly the Dodger and Giant fans who had felt abandoned. And, boy, he accomplished that. Mets got a lot right that first year. When you think about it, the name of the team, the logo, the song, the mascot, the broadcasters, the fans with their placards, as Casey would
say. The placards, yeah.
Hearing Casey. I mean, they got so much in the first year. So George Weiss may have been kind of a... an isolated figure sitting at his desk, but boy, the Mets did a lot right in 1962. And Casey was really not pushing the buttons anymore in terms of running the games. He let his coaches, Solly Emus and Cookie Lavaggetto, do the lineups, do the pitching rotations. Richie Ashburn in center field was kind of running the games from center field. And that's the way the Mets functioned. It didn't work. They only won 40 games.
Right.
But Casey was not engaged as he had been even to the end with the Yankees.
Now, people may not realize, too, Marty, that one of the greatest hitters in baseball history was a coach on for Casey on the 1962 Mets. And it must have taken some toll on him because he passed away right after that season.
Yeah, that would be Rogers Hornsby, who was a great ball player, but really never a great coach or a great manager. So, but Rogers Hornsby was part of the 62 Mets.
Certainly was. We got Marty Appel with us tonight, Sports Talk 1240. Describe, if you will, Marty, Stengelese.
Well, that was the language, as defined by the New York press for the most part, that Casey spoke. It was talk. And he said when he wanted to avoid an answer or when he was stalling time of an answer. He didn't really use it with the players, and he didn't use it with his friends or at home with his wife. But with the New York writers, they found it charming. And, of course, the most famous use of it was in front of a subcommittee of the United States Senate in 1958 when they were holding hearings on baseball's antitrust exemption. He was asked one question, and he proceeded to tell his life story in Stengelese, which meant kind of 20 minutes of nonstop, no punctuation in his sentences. And then, of course, the capo of the whole thing was Mickey Mantle following him up to the microphone and being asked one question, and Mickey just said, well, I agree with everything that Casey just said.
Yeah. That was definitely priceless, yes. Now, his relationship with Joe DiMaggio wasn't the best.
They were testing each other.
Okay.
Joe was the elite player in the game. Casey was this clownish reputation figure that Joe never really took all that seriously, other than respecting the office of manager. But there was a quick test on the first day of the first spring training together in 1949, when Casey laid down the rules for spring training, which included that players couldn't go to the dog track at night. DiMaggio did that every night. This was almost a rule imposed just to stick it to Joe DiMaggio. What happened was that DiMaggio went anyway, and when asked about it, Casey said, "Well, I wasn't there. I have no firsthand knowledge of this, so I have no comment." So it just went on, and they coexisted in that manner. Imagine today, 2,500 cell phone photos of Joe at the dog track and the newspaper headlines saying, "What now, Casey? Your move, Casey."
Yeah.
So it's a different time we live in today, for sure.
There was also a question, Marty, about Jackie Robinson and whether there was racism involved with Casey.
Like everything racism in America, it's a long and complicated answer.
Uh-huh.
It involves a lot of, on the one hand, on the other hand, Jackie thought, rightly so, that the Yankees were very slow in integrating. The Yankees were winning the World Series every year, didn't feel they were in a big rush to shake things up. So Jackie accused the Yankees of being racist. Casey, a good company man, knew where his paychecks were coming from, defended the Yankees and said Jackie was chock full of nuts. When the Yankees finally integrated with Elston Howard, you got to give Casey credit. He helped create an environment in which the transition of Ellie to the Yankees was smooth and without a bump, and Elston and Arlene Howard loved Casey Stengel. Arlene's still with us today, and she thinks the world of Casey Stengel's memory.
That's wonderful.
So that's got to say a lot about it right there.
Certainly. Great answer, Marty. Well, to quote Casey, there comes a time in every man's life, and I've had plenty of them. So, Marty, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us. The book, folks, is called Casey Stengel, Baseball's Greatest Character, available Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Of course, book review where Marty appealed. Marty, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Take care. Marty Appel, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Byron Scott and Marty Appel, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you next Sunday, May 14th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.